ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
David Bindi Hudson is a Western Yalanji and Uruman man who was taught the old culture and the art of the didgeridoo on his father's country in outback Queensland. David played rugby league for a while and then gave it away to become a teacher and a performer. And in the 1980s, he co-founded the award-winning Japukai Dance Company. But when he saw how popular didgeridoo performance was, David took the song of that ancient instrument and brought it to the world. And David has since performed in some amazing places with a huge orchestra at the Acropolis, at the Taj Mahal, and the Forbidden City in Beijing. And Marlon Brando, through a bizarre set of circumstances, became a fan of his music. And so, of course, naturally, David brought Marlon Brando over for dinner to his family home in far north Queensland. David Bindi Hudson is currently telling and performing his epic life through story and song in a touring stage show called From Campfire to Stage Light. Hello, David. Welcome to you.
Yundumai, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, sir. The story of your grandmother, your mum's mum, is a big part of who you are. Tell me about where her people were from.
Well, my mum was born at Mona Mona Mission outside of Caranda. That's on Jabbagai country. But her mother, she's from the Yalanji mob. They were removed from the Palmer River, Maytown, back around 1913.
Wasn't that a big gold rush area once back in the day?
Oh, it was humongous. So when the Californian gold rush ended, a lot of folks ended up in Maytown on the Palmer River, and it was full of life and full of gold, and Chinese were there, the Irish people were there. Hence why my great-grandfather was an Irishman named James Killian Grogan. He had children with an Aboriginal woman. And my grandmother was sent to Mona Mona, which was run by the Seventh-day Adventist Church. And if you're in Caranda these days, a lot of folks, if you're 60 and over, still don't eat pork to the day, and you don't eat prawns and, you know, shellfish because it's deemed unclean.
So your grandmother was taken away, you say, in 1915 and brought to the Mona Mona Mission. Did you ever get to know her, your grandmother?
No, because I was born in 62 and she passed in 62. By that stage, the mission had closed and everybody was, okay, folks, you're on your own now. So most of the residents moved to Cairns, Caranda or Mareeba.
Was she still the presence in your life, though, insofar as the stories people told about her?
Oh, very much so. My mum instilled in us the hardships they had to go through living on a mission, being told what to do. My mum's the eldest of nine kids. All those kids are born up in dormitories, separated from their parents. And I've always said that my folks were from a mission, but I was a Murray man on a mission now.
So when your mum and her siblings were born on the mission to your grandmother, who was on the mission, they were still separated within the mission from your grandmother.
Absolutely. You had the junior dormitories and you had the senior dormitories. So my mum, being the eldest, she had to take care of her younger siblings. But if you were younger, you'd be sent to the junior dormitories. And that's the way it was.
Were their lives really micromanaged? I've heard a lot of stories about Indigenous people from this time living on these missions or elsewhere, living under these intense conditions of micromanagement, to say the least. Was it like that?
Yes, it was. I would call it a religious, disciplined, clean living prison. It was one of those things where you couldn't just look at a bloke or a boy, you know. You had to look straight ahead and none of this nonsense of mucking around.
Nonetheless, didn't your mum meet your dad on this mission?
She did meet him on the mission, and my father's folks come from the southwest on Savannah country. My father and his brother and sisters were also lumped in with that same Mona Mona outfit. I've always said that culture was squeezed out of him. The language of Uruman was no longer spoken. Gone on this earth. Because on the mission, you're being dictated to what you can do and what you can't do. And my mum, she was a very strong-willed woman. She walked off the mission back in the 30s and went to the Atherton Tablelands to find a job milking cows and building fences. And then it was a time of when the soldiers started arriving up there, so she got scared and ran back to the only place she knows, and that's Mona Mona Mission. But in 1956, my mum walked off the mission with my two brothers and my sister, and she walked all the way to a place called Caranda, 18 kilometres away. And the bloke there said, you know, Esme, you are not allowed off the mission because you don't have an exemption card. So he helped her apply for an exemption card, which meant that this was her so-called Australian passport to live outside of the mission. And without that certificate, Aboriginal people were not allowed to leave the mission.
See, I think stories like this just blow people's minds these days. The idea that you needed an internal passport within Australia. Today, it sounds incredibly weird and strange. So she'd walked off the mission with her kids, gone to Kiranda without the permission. Did she get the permission eventually?
She got her exemption granted. But on the side of my mum's original exemption card, on the side, it states very clearly, at any point that the Director of Native Affairs wants to throw this away in the bin, they can. They've got the rights to do that.
When your mum left with the kids to go to Kiranda, where was your dad? Did he stay on the mission when your mum walked off?
Yeah, my dad stayed on the mission because he was sceptical. And he said, you know, Esme, you know, we shouldn't be doing this. And she said, that's no problem. You stay on the mission, but I'm leaving. So she left him on the mission, and when the mission closed in 1960, well, he obviously rejoined because I'm born in 1962. But I state very clearly that I was born in 62 without citizenship in this country of ours until 1967 comes for Aboriginal people to vote in this country. After 62, after I'm born, my mum, I say she has itchy feet. You know, she wants to leave home and she gets herself a job on a cattle station to the west. And she takes me out there, and for the first 6 years of my life, I've been given this opportunity of breathing in pure country air. You know, I grew up with the smell of leather saddlebags. I grew up with the smell of horses. And I grew up with Uruman people, my older cousins and uncle and aunts, who were out there working as housekeepers or ringers. So I have a very good cultural background in regards to my elders teaching me my skills and my culture. They tell me stories about the land and the animals. And so I was very, very fortunate to have that early childhood upbringing.
Where was this station?
It was called Spring Creek and Rosetta Plain Station to southwest. So going out on the savannah, volcanic craters, hot springs, gem fields, and it's beautiful country. It's fresh air, it's fresh water. You know, even though I was born and raised in Cairns, I'm not a saltwater person. I'm a freshwater Murray.
I've been on that trip quite a few times coming in from the coast from Kiranda on the road up to Cooktown, and you go through that country through there, and it's completely different country. What does the air smell like? What kind of sense impressions does it give you when you're on that land, David?
Oh, it's dry country. I can smell the deep, rich escarpments of oxide. I can smell eucalyptus trees. I can smell rock art. It's an ancient smell, and it's very, very different to the rainforest because, to me, the rainforest has this, it's a flower smell. It's a lot more green, of course, and I'm smelling, I don't want to say, but I'm smelling mildew, and it's very different because when I travel to the west and I get to the certain point where we're sea elevated, the whole thing changes for me, and I get this homeland feeling that I'm back on the homelands, and I'm okay. I feel safe.
The light is different there too, isn't it?
Oh yeah. See, on my mum's side, we have Yalanji, which so coastal is Kuku Yalanji. I'm Western Yalanji because we're west of the Great Divide. So the folks on the eastern coast, they're sunrise people. To the west, we're sunset people. So we see the sun go down, and you don't get those sunsets on the coast because we're getting all the hazes, we're getting the purples, we're getting the oranges, and that's what makes that sky very, very different to living on the coast.
And the clouds go on forever, don't they?
The clouds are the cumulus clouds, you know, and the more you go out towards, on that road that goes out to Normanton, you're getting those long clouds. It's open country, it's sparse, but it's a sense of being on country.
So you were there on this land where you were able to breathe clean air, you say, as a small child. Who was there to give you the old culture?
Oh, I had my older cousins. These are Uruman people who had avoided the initial roundup back in that day to be taken to a mission. These folks were on a station where they worked, and the Collins family supported Aboriginal people. So having these elders there was my best medicine. They nurtured me and they gave me my cultural upbringing. It was fantastic, and I don't know what I would have done if I'd never had that opportunity to have that connection. So I've got to thank those elders. I've got to thank my mum for taking me out to my father's country, and the rest is history.
How did you get the name Bindi?
Well, I was out there, and by the time I'm about 3 or 4 or 5, these elders, they tell me these stories. They teach me to dance traditional Warama style, and then they sit me down. They sit me on the ground. They say, "Come here, boy." They look into my eyes, but way beyond my eyes. Then they grind this earth, and they mingle it with water. And then they dip their fingers into this ochre paste they've made, and they mark my face. And then they say, "Your name is Bindi, boy." And I'm like, "Bindi? Yeah, Bindi, forward vision, always looking forward." And that's where the name came from.
Have you thought about that all your life, that name?
I've always thought about it because I've always been taught that to survive in this world, one has to always be ahead of the game. And the only hand is going to help me is attached to my elbow. And I've always remembered that. And once the station period had finished, my mum took me back to the Big Smoke, you know, to go to school. Of course, there was a Seventh-day Adventist school. My older brother, Donnie, he gave me a guitar. He says, "David, learn 3 or 5 chords." He shows me, and then I'm playing it now, and I'm playing, you know, country music, rock and roll, blues. And Donnie, you know, Donnie's playing by ear. So what goes from Donnie's ear, it goes into my ear. And then I'm in a band. I learn to play the clarinet and the trumpet, kit drums. I play the guitar. But those mission morals are still running deep. So my mum wants me to be an educated man. You know, "David, you know, you've got to go to college. You've got to go to university. At least finish grade 12. And I'm like, "Oh, mum, enough. You know, stop. Music's got a hold of me. And footy's got a hold of me. And she's like, "Oh, David, come on. Let's be realistic here. You've got to become a teacher. You've got to be a banker. You've got to be a businessman. Mum, come on. That music's got a hold of me. It's got a hold of me the proper way."
You had a stutter when you were a child. What's the story behind the stutter, Dave?
I did have a stutter when I was bad and when I was young. And I've got to say this in a very comedic style, because one of my older mates married my cousin, and his name was Teddy. And Teddy was a ringer on the station where I was raised. And Teddy, to the day, still stutters and stammers. And so I've always blamed Teddy because I copied him.
Well, how long did that continue for? Because you don't seem to stutter now.
Well, I stopped stuttering because I went to Perth and I went to college over there. And now I'm like confronted with a whole group of classmates. And to get up there and do a lecture, I'm now sweating. I'm now packing it. I'm like, "Oh, no." So I go to a hypnotist, and the hypnotist sits me down and he tells me, "David, think about this. You play one of the world's oldest instruments, the didgeridoo. And when you play a didgeridoo, you've got to blow down the tube, suck air through your nose at the same time, and you've got to control your breathing. So what you've got to do is control your breathing, slow it down, think about what you want to say, and that's exactly how I overcome my stutter."
So you finished school, and that's when you went to Alice Springs. How many jobs did you do there?
I wanted to venture out into the big wide world, so I jumped in my motor car with my cousin. Off we chuff, we go to Alice Springs, the heart of this country, and I'm unemployed. So I get a job as a pest exterminator, but then I realise, hang about, I suffer from hay fever. Then I try a job in a bottle shop, but then I'm thinking, hey, I'm a teetotaler. Then I get a job as a health worker, and I hate hospital smell, and now I'm surrounded by doctors giving needles. And then I get the job on the railways, and it's fantastic because I'm now outdoors. I'm now breathing the desert air. We're replacing all the wooden sleepers with concrete sleepers all the way down from Alice to Adelaide. And I'm earning like $800 a week as an 18, 19-year-old kid. I'm thinking, wow, I've got it made.
That is pretty good money in the 1970s. So what were you doing with the money?
Mate, I did not trust putting my money into a bank.
Right.
So I used to keep my money in a sock, and I called it the Bank of Socklands. I kept it under my bed. Seriously, I have thousands of dollars in a sock. It's ridiculous.
So it was around about this time you got to meet your partner, Cindy, when you were playing football. Tell me how that came about.
Oh, look, I was playing footy, and there was four rugby league teams in Alice Springs, and one of my footy mates has a girlfriend who works at the Alice Springs Hospital. Now, I think to myself, oh, okay, well, if you see one nurse, there's normally a flock of them. You know, they always tend around and go in groups. And these nurses would always come down to footy and watch the game. Then they stay for a barbecue. And I spot this one good-looking blonde-haired girl, and her name was Cindy. And she gives me a lift home, and very smooth with her, I say, hey, Cindy, do you want to stop it at the servo and have a cup of tea?
Because you're a teetotaler, aren't you? That means
I'm a teetotaler. Right. And she says back to me, well, why don't you just come back to my place for a cuppa? I thought, what the hell? And it was the best cup of tea ever. So from that moment there, I quickly move out of the railway quarters into the nurse's quarters. And I shouldn't be doing this, of course, but Margaret, the housekeeper, I get on pally with Margaret, and my mum would send me over an esky, you know, full of tropical fruit and barramundi. So I get on pally with Margaret. I give Margaret some of the goodies just to keep it quiet, you know, on the low.
So you'd already started playing the didge at this stage. Now, I don't really know much at all about how a didgeridoo is made. How do you make a didgeridoo?
Oh, well, a didgeridoo is made out of a tree that's hollowed out by termites naturally. And I want to acknowledge Gublethalidon, because Gublethalidon is an artist, or was an artist, who gave me the time to go out into the bush, select that tree, how to look for the signs that termites have eaten the inside out, chop into the tree with an axe, and then you hit the tree on the ground, and out comes all the mud and clay where the termites used to live. And then you strip all the bark back it, so now you have just a wood instrument. What people don't realise is that the length of your didgeridoo determines your key. So say a 6-foot didgeridoo, that's going to be around the key of an A. So once you start cutting your didgeridoo, you can tune your didge to A, B, C, D. So in my studio, I've got all the different keys.
Right, so you can create a drone that'll sit as the tonic of whatever key you're playing in to sit.
Absolutely, yeah. So someone, you go to a gig and someone says, oh, Dave, you got your didge. I'll say, what key is your song in? They'll say, oh, it's in B. I'm going, I can't help you. I've got a didge in E. Your song's in B. Oh, okay.
So you and Cindy moved to Perth and you started going to Teachers College there. And
yep.
How did you start taking the didge more seriously when you got to Perth?
I got to Perth and I was over there, and the first Aboriginal comedian bloke that I met was Ernie Dingo and Richard Wally, Yamaji man and a Noongar man, and they ran the Midard dance troupe, and they'd meet me and they asked if I danced, and, you know, I said, absolutely. So I said, look, I can shake a leg or two, so I didgeridoo. These fellas were already there with a dance troupe. They were performing down at Pioneer Village, Armidale, and back then I had a motorbike and I had my didgeridoo strapped over the handlebars that ran under my arm. So any car that was passing me would see this bloke riding a motorbike with a didge attached. You know, they're probably thinking, was that a muffler or was that a didgeridoo? And that was probably my learning curve, because I realised through that Midard dance troupe, it planted a seed in my mind that perhaps I could go out beyond my own campfire and take it out to the stage light. And that's exactly what I did in 1985. I had this opportunity of travelling to America for my first trip.
Playing the didge as part of ceremony must be a completely different thing to playing the didge as a stage performance for people who are outside the tradition.
Exactly, because when you play it in a traditional sense, a lot of my older uncles, Gublethalidon, probably didn't realise that the didgeridoos came in, you know, B's and C's and D's if you cut it at the different length. However, they were smart enough to know that if you would do a pelican dance, you would play a long didgeridoo. If you're doing a willy wagtail dance, you play a short didgeridoo, because there's not a moment a willy wagtail stands still. He's always moving around, his tail's moving around. Willigy, we call him. And so when you take the didgeridoo to the next level, you now start playing with the guitar or the piano. And I've been very fortunate to play the didgeridoo with many instruments, from zitars to cellos to double basses. It's such a Mother Earth's sound. People just love the didgeridoo. So I've always called it the ancient voice of the future.
Where's the future element?
Well, I tell you now, the didgeridoo is not so much done by Aussies, but done by people in Europe, where they take the instrument now and they're putting in little speakers so that you can play a didgeridoo that you can hear yourself. And they've taken it to another level.
Do you like that? What do you think of that?
Oh, well, I call those didgeridons. Well, it's too easy, you know. We have the authentic didgeridoos in Australia, where termites eat them out naturally. People overseas, they make them out of resin. They make them out of fiberglass. And so they can't call it didgeridoo, so I call it a didgeridon't.
So, as you said, in 1985, you got an invitation to play in the United States. Where were you playing?
It's a funny story, because I came home from Perth on one of my college's break, and I go to Crandon to visit my family, and my mum's brother says to me, Uncle Finley, he says to me, "Hey, David, we go up here, and I'll put my hat down, and you play the didgeridoo." And I was like, "What for?" He goes, "No, you just try it. I'll put the hat down, you play the didge." And so I did that, and within about 30 minutes, I had $80 in my hat, in my uncle's hat. And I said, "Oh, my goodness, I've got $80. I know I'm deadly, but, Uncle, you proper deadly." And then at the same time at the markets, there was this Aussie woman that had been back time and time again to find this Murray fellow with curly hair that played the didgeridoo. Well, I'm going back to Perth. And then she starts asking questions, you know, I saw this bloke, he played the didgeridoo, he had curly hair. And so the locals are thinking, "No, I don't know who you're talking about. Oh, you know, go and ask old Jim, you know. Jim's at the Honey House. No, don't know who that bloke is. Go and ask old Marjorie. You know, she's at the macrame store in the markets. No, don't know who that bloke is. Go and ask those Aboriginal blokes up in the main street." And they're like, "Oh, curly, oh, I think they're looking for David. You know, they've got to go and talk to Auntie Ez." Now, back in that day, that's pre-mobile phone world. So my mum doesn't have the phone. They don't know my number, but they're told to ring my aunt, who works at the hospital. And my aunt says, "Yeah, that's my nephew. Look, leave it with me. I'll track him down." My aunt rings me. She goes, "David, you've got to ring these people, Diane Hook or something, something about going to America." I says, "What are you talking about?" She goes, "They want to take you to America. Ring this person, please." So I ring this bloke called Daryl Hook, and I'm going, "Daryl, it's David Hudson." He goes, "David Hudson, geez, you're a hard bloke to track down." He says, "Look, we're going to go to America. We're going to be performing in the Napa Valleys, the Marin County, Berkeley campuses, you know, these art galleries, and we want you to come and play the didgeridoo at the start of these shows." So I said, "No American's going to sit back and listen to some little Aboriginal bloke playing a didgeridoo." He says, "Come on, David, it's going to be big." I said, "Look, I've got a girlfriend." He goes, "Bring your girlfriend too. We'll pay for her." I'm like, "Wow." And now I'm living my dream. I'm like, "Wow, I'm going to America."
And how did the Americans respond to these performances up and down the coast of California?
They were captivated. They loved the sound of the didgeridoo. And the sound was, it resonated. And I it's so funny thinking back on this now, because I've got to tell you the story, because we're staying in Redondo Beach, and we've got this truck. It's full of artwork, and it's got all these crates of wine that they serve at these shows. And I travel with Daryl in the truck, and it's midnight one night at Redondo Beach, and Daryl says to me, "Have you got the key?" I said, "I don't have the key. Have you got the key?" He says, "No." So here's Daryl and I trying to lift up windows and the doors, and the next minute the cops arrive, and the cops walk up, hands on their holsters. And we're like, "Oh, evening, officer." And next minute, Daryl and I are spread eagle on the truck. And he's like, "Put your hands up." I'm like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 calm down." Daryl's trying to explain to him, "Listen, we're Australians. Open the truck up. He shines the light in. What do you think he sees? Artwork. Loads and loads of artwork and all this wine. It doesn't look good. Daryl's trying to explain, mate, we're Aussies, mate. We're over here trying to sell Australian art. And this is my mate, David. He plays a didgeridoo. The cops go, he plays the what? He blows that stick over there. And the cop says, all right, blow that stick over there. And I blow the stick. And the whole scene changes. The cop says into his speaker, he goes, hey, Rog, come up here. You got to check this out. There's a guy up here blowing into a stick.
So you didn't spend the night in the watch house. Isn't that nice?
Thank goodness.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler.
So when you got back from America, David, you started teaching kids in schools throughout Queensland. Now, I remember seeing it when I was a kid, also not in Queensland, but I can remember as a kid, kids were fascinated with the didgeridoo. As kids, we're kind of really drawn to the didgeridoo. Is that what you found when you started performing in schools?
Yeah, it was fantastic because the didgeridoo is like the Pied Piper. He plays the flute and all these people just come and they gather around the didgeridoo. It's true Australian sound. You hear the didgeridoo and you're captivated immediately and you're drawn in. And I called my show True Blue Didgeridoo back in that day. I came home on the plane and I said to Cindy, why don't I get the same reaction back in Australia like I did in America? You know, the people over there were absolutely hungry for my culture. So I came home and I said, we should write a letter to the education department about touring a school. And Arts Council said, have you got a show? And I, on the spot, I said, yep, I got a show called True Blue Didgeridoo. I just made it up on the spot. And they said, fantastic, what do you do? I said, oh, well, I play the didgeridoo. I teach kids how to, you know, imitate kangaroos and emus and brolgers. We make fire the traditional way. And it was such a edutaining way of telling my story but educating kids.
That job put you in touch with the Brian Young Country Band. Now, Brian Young, he was one of those old school travelling country musos, like Slim Dusty, wasn't he?
Yep, absolutely. And I grew up on Brian Young's music, as I did with Slim. And to be asked to go on tour with Brian Young was my dream come true. You know, to go on tour, and we toured all over Australia, you know, and we're going to remote communities all the way from, you know, Uluru, Warburton Ranges, the Kimberleys, Pepmanardi, Arnhem Land, Borroloola, you know, and to have the opportunity. But what Brian said to me was, David, why don't you, in the first half, tell your story about who you are with the didgeridoo? And I was like, yeah, that sounds good. And he says, in the second half, come out and play country music. And I thought, wow, yeah. So to be given that opportunity of doing that was fantastic. And, of course, one of my iconic heroes growing up was Jimmy Little.
Oh, yes.
So to be able to tour with Jimmy Little and Roger Knox and all those people, I was like, I'm living my dream again.
In 1987, you made an album of solo didgeridoo music, and you were sceptical about the whole idea of an album of solo didgeridoo music selling well, but how did it do when it came out?
My mate said, David, you've got to record a solo didgeridoo album. And I said, why? Who would listen to a whole album of just didgeridoo? He goes, I know the market. People don't know the sound of the didgeridoo, and once they hear the different rhythms, they'll be captivated. And believe it or not, it sells 150,000 copies that year alone.
Oh.
And I was absolutely blown away, mesmerised. So I thought, well, if a solo didgeridoo can sell that many albums, imagine if I did didgeridoo and percussion, didgeridoo and guitar, didgeridoo and piano. And that's exactly what I did.
That same year, you co-founded the dance theatre company, Jopukai, in Kiranda, and you were in demand, and in no time you're touring all over the world, right throughout Europe. Now, I remember there was a huge hunger in Europe in those years, and probably still so, for ancient indigenous Australian culture. I saw an exhibition of Western Desert painting in Paris around about that time that was packed out, full of people that were people who were in awe of the paintings they were seeing on the wall. And I got the impression at the time that Australian Indigenous culture was filling something that was missing in their lives, or something from the European soul at the time. Did you get that impression?
Oh, absolutely. You know, here we are. One minute it's North Italy, where we're going to France, we're going to Austria, we're going to Germany, we're going to London. And to play in places that we've only could even dream of. For example, here we are performing in Berlin, Dusseldorf, Bonn. We're performing in these places. The Savoy. The Savoy Hotel was a real ritzy hotel. When you enter the Savoy, you have to wear a suit. And we all rock up in our, you know, our blue jeans and our jubba guy shirts, and they're like, whoa, 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 what's going on here? We said, oh, hey, you've got to let us in. We're performing tonight in the Savoy. And they're like, you're performing where? We're performing in the ballroom at the Savoy. And so we took a film crew with us, and we filmed our travels through Europe, America, Canada, and so forth. And I knew from then that this was also another turning circle. All the links to my chain was happening. There's art, as you say. There's our music. There's the didgeridoo. And people in Europe, they're from an old ancient culture themselves. Their buildings are, it's not just glass and concrete. These buildings are 1,000 years old. They're older. And when you're performing in the castle, you sort of feel at home as well. And I felt all right. I feel safe. The only thing that was different about it was we're performing in these cold climates where we're on stage with no clothes on. And it's minus five.
So it was at this point in your life that you met Marlon Brando. Now, this is one of the most bizarre stories. Tell me how it was you became part of a Hollywood film and Marlon Brando's life at this point, please.
I get this phone call from Richard Stanley, the director of The Island of Dr. Moreau. And we finally meet, and Tim Zinnemann, the line producer, and I said, how did you find me of all places? I live in Cairns, a small town. And Richard said to me, he says, you know, David, you were performing in the Shaw Theatre, West End, London, and I was in the audience, and I came to your show out of interest, and I saw you up on stage doing the kangaroo and the emu, and I said in my mind immediately, if I'm going to use anybody to do the choreography, I want that gentleman up there. And that's how I got the gig as a choreographer.
So this is The Island of Dr. Moreau, based on the H.G. Wells book where you have a mad scientist on an island who's creating creatures that are part animal and part human. This was famously was going to be one of the most disastrous movie shoots in the history of Hollywood, this was, and you were drawn into it. But you came out unscathed, and better than unscathed. This was going to be with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer. What did you do when you found out that you were going to be in this film with these two people?
Well, they first wanted me to be the choreographer, you know, to teach the actors how to move. So, you know, I'm thinking, oh, well, sure, kangaroos, emus, cassowaries. Oh, no, far from that. We're talking about hyenas and bear, monkeys and gorilla. And I'm like, as if I'd know. So I get the script and I said, you know, show me that script, please. I was a bit suspect. I'm like, I'm reading the script. And I'm going, the doctor is played by Marlon Brando. Are you serious, Marlon Brando? And his assistant's going to be played by Val Kilmer. And I said, yeah, I'll be your choreographer, no problem. But I want a role in this. And I said, who's playing the dog man? They said, oh, that's played by Tamura Morrison, you know, once a Warriors. And I said, well, the goat man, who's playing the goat man? They said, Ron Perlman. And Richard said, do you love buffaloes, David? I said, oh, I love buffaloes. So I became the bison man. and prosthetics for these things was up to like an hour and a half, 2 hours of prosthetics every day. So I had to go down to Sydney. I had to spend a whole day standing around having latex, you know, fiddled around my arms. I had to have a helmet fiddled on my head. And now I'm being transformed into a bison. I've got false teeth. I've only got one eye. I've got hoofed for my hands. I've now got a limp, you know what I mean? So now I've got to move like a bison. Yeah, so, you know, we get to work, we sit back in the chair, we go to sleep, our makeup artist goes to work on us, and we wake up an hour later, transform into a bison. There's hyena swine to my left, I've got boar men to my right. I've got the sow ladies in front of me. They're being done up as now they're pigs.
It's like being the Muppets, isn't it?
Oh, it was absolutely. And Brando was one of those old fellas up in the ranks up there. So John Frankenheimer took over as the second director because Richard Stanley got fired by Val Kilmer. And I've got to say that because Val took a dislike to Richard, and I give my thanks to Richard because if it weren't for Richard, I wouldn't be in the Island of Dr. Moreau.
Val took a dislike to Richard and everyone took a dislike to Val after that. That's pretty.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But having the opportunity to work with someone like Marlon Brando was my cup of tea.
So how did he make contact with you?
Well, at this stage, he's still got no idea what I look like because every time he sees me, I'm a bison. And then one day the phone rings and I picked it up and I said, oh, hello.
He goes, oh, good morning, David.
I said, yes.
He goes, oh, yeah, you know, David, this is Marlon.
And I put the phone to my chest. I said, Marlon who?
He goes, oh, it's Marlon Brando. I work with you.
I said to Cindy, I said, I think this is Marlon Brando calling me. And I said, yes.
He goes, oh, David, I've been given your music. It's absolutely beautiful. And the didgeridoo music is absolutely spelling. It's relaxing. I love it.
And I was, you know, I don't shut up for much, you know, but I was gobsmacked that this bloke's ringing me to tell me that he's been given my music and he's telling me about the didgeridoo. And I said, that's all great, Marlon. And whilst I've got you, would you want to come up to Crandra and meet my family? And he says,
oh, it'll be beautiful, David. Yes, absolutely.
I ring my mum. I said, Mum, I'm bringing Marlon Brando up for lunch next week, as you do. And I reminded my mum, I said, Mum, this bloke used to live in Pepieti, Tahiti, so he's used to eating the same tuckers as us, so Mum knows what to cook. So up comes Marlon Brando. Here he is, the man himself. And he's lying on the grass over there talking to Mum's brothers, you know, about boxing and movies. My mum's done all the cooking. And she now, you know, everybody, come on, the tucker's ready, you know, and she's the eldest, you know, all right, you sit down there, David, and Cindy, you sit down there. She tells my aunt, right, Rose, you sit down there. And she says to Marlon, how old are you? He's like,
oh, I'm only 78, Mrs. Hudson.
And she says, well, I'm 80 years of age, Marlon, so sit down there. He sits down like a little boy. We sit around this table that's full of taro, sweet potato, chicken, fish, cooked and grated coconut milk, damper. And I said to Marlon, what's your do's and your don'ts? He goes, oh, not a problem, Dave. I'm a vegetarian. And I'm telling you, this day, his plate was built like a mountain. And I said, hey, I thought you told me you were a vegetarian. He's like,
he said, you know, Dave, I don't eat this particular food every day, but to have food like this cooked by your family, I'm not a vegetarian today.
And that's when Marl and I hit it off. I realised from then, that moment, that his passion was promoting Indigenous cultures worldwide. And I was fortunate to have this bloke come up and spend time with myself and my family in a small little cultural hub like Karanda. It's something I'll never forget.
I can't help but also note, David, that this is a man who's broken the lives and careers of so many Hollywood directors and incredibly powerful people. How long did it take your mum to get him into line to sit at the right part of the table?
She just said, I'm older than you. I'm 80 years of age. Sit down there. Yes, Mrs. Hudson.
Sounds like you could have used a lot more time in the company of your mum, I think.
Absolutely. No, Mum, she was the eldest of 9 kids. She was the boss lady, and a lot of folks know my mum because of her attitude to life, and she was a strong-willed woman. And so my mum inspired me to the kilt, you know what I mean? So she inspired me to who I am as David Hudson today.
So then, David, you went on this insane tour in the 1990s for some years with the Greek musician and composer Yanni, who brought you on board to play with a 30-piece orchestra, to play at the Taj Mahal and the Forbidden City in China. That's amazing. But what was the bureaucratic process like about, you know, getting into the Taj Mahal? I don't think they'd let anyone, too many people in there to perform.
Yeah, it actually wasn't inside the Taj, but we're using the Taj as this humongous backdrop.
Right.
But once again, the phone rings, and it's Mark St. Louis. David, is this David Hudson? Yes, speaking. He goes, David, I'm the tour manager for a Greek composer called Yanni. Have you heard of him? And I said, yes, I have. He goes, well, he's heard of you with your music as well. I'm going, I'm now thinking to myself, that must have been the album that I thought would never, ever sell. And he says, he's got me to ring you, and he's inviting you to be part of his 30-piece orchestra to perform at the Taj Mahal, India, and the Forbidden City, China. And he says, Mark says, I'll give you a week to think about it, and I'm counting on my fingers. Taj Mahal, Forbidden City, China, 30-piece orchestra, I'm coming. Don't you worry about that. I'm coming. And he says to me, David, you're from Australia, so it might be easier if you apply for your work visas. I said, yeah, no problem. So I send my form off. Reasons for going to India and China, I just put down musician and to play the didgeridoo. The phone rings. It's Mary from the Indian consulate. She goes, David, it says on your form that you're going to perform at the Taj Mahal. I said, that's right. She goes, nobody performs at the Taj Mahal. And I said, Mary, I will be performing at the Taj Mahal in Agra, India. She goes, David, it's not possible. And I said, with Yanni, it was possible. And then I reflected back to my Jubba Guide days. You know, here we were performing to only, you know, 4 or 5 people. But with Yanni, now it was 20,000 people night after night after night. And here we are, the United Nations of Musicians, performing at these iconic locations. And it was like a bucket list of places that a person that suffers from chronic itchy feet might write. You know, I'm writing down, wow, I've just performed at the Taj, the Forbidden City, China, Madison Square Garden, Radio City, the pyramids in Mexico City. I'm living my dream.
Did you feel it? You said you felt at home in Europe in some of the castles, which were medieval, which go back, you know, 1,000 years. But when you're playing in those pyramids in Mexico City, and you played at the Acropolis in Greece. Now we're talking properly ancient here, not as ancient as your culture, of course, but it's properly ancient. Did that resonate with you as well at the time?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the people there, being in Greece or Italy or those places, it's realistically like I'm in Australia. Italian families, Greek families, they take you in as family. My family's huge. So if you're going to go to Cape York or to the Savannah country and Richard, you go up there and you say that you're a mate of Dave Hudson, your family immediately. So to be able to perform at these iconic locations, I was considered family. And that just made, I was very honoured by that.
You found this huge appetite for Australian Indigenous culture all over the world. And like I said, I've seen this myself being out in the world. But as you say, initially, not so much in Australia. What do you think that's about?
Oh, look, I just think that, once again, Australians need to fully get a grasp of who we are in this country of ours. We've got to pay homage to the traditional people of this country. We live in a country that has the world's oldest living culture in our own backyards. But Aussies just don't get it. And yet, if you ask the average Aussie, name me 4 Native American tribes, oh, they can tell me, oh, yeah, it's easy, yeah, Comanches, you know, we've got the Apaches, we've got Cheyennes, you know, we've got the Hopis. Now tell me 3 First Nations mob in Australia, and they're like, they're thinking, and that's my point. We live in this country, we grow up with television, American TV. So for me growing up, it was all about, you know, watching Mr. Ed and Get Smart. And that's my point. Why don't we just take a sit back and listen? Or do Aussies sort of just roll over and hit the snooze button and turn back because everything's too hunky-dory? You know, it's too easy, too cozy.
Are you noticing change, though? Because I can think of the first time I went to Cairns and the difference between Cairns and my most recent visit to Cairns. And there's so much more Indigenous imagery around the city now, and a lot of that, of course, is for the benefit of tourists and what have you. Nonetheless, I think there's so much more of Indigenous culture that's becoming part of the warp and weft of daily life in Australia. Are you seeing that, or am I do you think I'm imagining that?
No, you're not imagining it at all. That's true. I would say that Gimoi, which is the traditional language word for Cairns, is very, very synonymous now, because my high school is Cairns State High School, but it's also got Gimoi on the other side. So anybody driving past would know, oh, what's that word there? Oh, that means Cairns Gimoi High School. You go down the city area, Shield Street, you've got this whole area that's now promoted to Indigenous arts and lights at night. You've now got the old courthouse that's now dedicated to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander culture. And it's so great to see this is a large population of Indigenous people in Cairns, far north Queensland. You know, you've got Bryony Robinson, his fish at the lagoon. You know, you've got stingrays here, and you've got across the river, across the inlet, you've got Munding Gilboy. They've got their own boat crews now. So definitely in Gimoi, you've got more cultural enterprise that's being established now. You've got the Mossman Cultural Centre, you've got the Munding Gilboy, you've got Rainforest Station, Pamagiri. So certainly a lot more now in the last 15 years or so. Back when we had Jabbagai, there was only just us.
You mentioned that when your mum walked off the mission with a bunch of kids, she managed to get herself an exemption card, which was the thing that gave her legal permission in the end to walk off that mission. A few years later, there was the referendum and Aboriginal people were to be counted in the census and become proper citizens in their own country once more. What did she do with that exemption card after that?
I've got my mum's exemption card, and I always tell the story that my mum had walked off the mission, and then in the early 60s, family would say to my mum, oh, come on, mum, you don't need that exemption card anymore. That law's finished with us. But she'd say, no, I'm leaving it in my bag. You never know. And I make a point of saying, we've come through the lockdowns and we've come through COVID, and all this talk about exemptions, that certainly makes my mob, you know, nervous, because there's a lot of older folks out there that have still got their exemption cards. And when you were told that you couldn't travel because of COVID, there you go. It hit home again.
David, I'm really struck by one sort of theme in one of the themes of your life, which is you're born in these circumstances on a mission where there's very little personal liberty. There's not much freedom at all. And now you, for a long while, have been living this life of enormous freedom, being out in the world, performing, being proud of your culture, taking it all over the place. This seems to be like a life of real, profound freedom, the freedom that's kind of important to you.
Absolutely. I've always said that my family were from a mission, and I was a Murray man on a mission now. So I was going to go out into the big wide world and take advantage of who I was as Dave Hudson, as a musician, entertainer, culturalist, voice for my people, because what my folks couldn't do on the mission, what they couldn't accomplish, I wanted to fulfill their dreams. And so that's exactly what I did. I was living my dream. You know, I said that I toured with Brian. That was one dream that was taken care of. I travelled with the Island of Dr. Moreau stuff. That was all another dream. Then the Yarni dream. So all my bucket list is now being full. You know, my bucket is getting full, but there's more change that needs to be happening in this country of ours. And that's why I say Aussies just need to just sit back, breathe a bit more, and realise that the ancient culture is here. Take a grasp of it, smell it, and be part of it. You know, we want to reconcile together.
You're a man who's gone from a mission to being on his own mission, a better mission.
I don't take things for granted, not at all. And after 1992, when Mabo came about, you know, for the first time we've been given a first shot at claiming land title. As long as you were an original owner, you could claim ownership over that land, which is a good thing. But never, ever take it for granted, because things can change in the blink of an eye.
David, it's been a real pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your story.
Oh, thank you, Richard. It's been a pleasure talking to you, and thank you very much, mate.
Today's conversation was made on Gadigal, Turrbal and Jagera lands and was produced by Alice Moldovan. Our EP is Carmel Rooney. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
What's it like to be there in person at a moment that shapes history?
We turned around from the command post and then there was round zinging over our head then.
I had some friends that were just like, okay, I've got someone hiding in my car. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm just going to drive.
You know your life is never going to be the same again because you're suddenly aware. Oh, I knew I'd never have another day like that.
G'day, Kirk Docker here. I've been working on a new show for ABC TV called I Was Actually There. For the show, we've found people who are on the ground at nation-defining moments and brought them together to tell those stories. For our podcast, we're doing things a bit differently by focusing on just one person and sharing more of their story in gripping, vivid detail. You'll hear what it was like to survive the Boxing Day tsunami.
I immediately went to a narrative in my head of, you know, what could this be? Maybe there was a bulldozer out of control or a truck or something like that, because that's how it felt. It didn't feel like water.
And what it was like to be trapped underground for 14 days in the Beaconsfield mine collapse.
When you're underground, you can't see 2 millimetres in front of you. The darkness of underground is just black.
Follow the show on the ABC Listen app to get every episode.